The 2016-17 NBA season is in the books. The Golden State Warriors are champions, defeating the Cleveland Cavaliers 129-120 in what was another epic yarn of a game in a series that was just incredibly enjoyable from an aesthetic standpoint. We'll get to all of our observations from Oracle Arena as the Warriors took this one. We're sponsored today by Quip Toothbrush. Getquip.com/capspace will give you your first refill pack free. And our old friends at SeatGeek, use the capspace code to get a $20 rebate off of your first SeatGeek purchase. I think I want to just start by appreciating the basketball that we saw in this series, really after game one. This is probably the highest level of offensive basketball between two teams that I think we may ever see in our lifetimes. And I don't want to forget about that.
Yeah, I wanted to start with the Cavs too, in that kind of a realm, because Cleveland really did deliver in game five. And overall, there were a couple of laggy moments. But other than that, I mean, LeBron was spectacular. He averaged a triple-double for the series, something like 34, 12, and 10. He was massive again. Another great first quarter. He's been great in every single first, or was great in every single first quarter of the series. And then the other guy who just, he's come on in the last couple of games, J.R. Smith. The shots that he hits are just mind-bending in a series full of guys who hit mind-bending shots.
J.R. Smith had 25 points on 11 shooting possessions in this game. That might be an efficiency record for someone who scored 25 points. Like, that's got to be up there. And he was 9 of 11 from the field overall, 7 of 8 from 3 on some very, very difficult attempts, including one like 30 footer as the half expired, another one in the third quarter fading away. And in the last three games of the series, he was 17 of 28 from three-point range. I mean, just, and the Cavs overall shot 11 of 24. We'll get, obviously, much more into just the overall strategy of this game and our impressions of it. But yeah, I said it on the last show. I mean, these are two of the five best offenses ever, I think, when you consider just what these teams have done in the playoffs. The fact that they played small most of the time, it definitely, Cleveland had less answers for Golden State, and Golden State generally made Cleveland take harder shots, with the exceptions of games 3 and 4. But Cleveland was quite capable of making plenty of those shots. And it was really just an outstanding performance by them, especially in that third quarter when you felt that the Warriors were just threatening to break it open at any moment. And they had led by as much as 17 near the end of the second quarter. Just be able to withstand that, get it back within 4 points at one point. It was just outstanding. But this Warriors team ultimately was just too much. And I think that a lot of the credit for this game has to go with Steve Kerr, because he stopped messing around in this game to a fairly ridiculous degree.
Yeah, I think that's one of the other big stories of this game. Was so Andre Iguodala played 21 minutes in game four, and I think he played something like 51 total in the two games in Cleveland. He played 38 minutes and 7 seconds. And remember, those were both halves. He did the kind of what I've called, I think you're the one who coined it, the Nikola Mirotic, where he sat at the beginning and then played the whole rest. And so for a guy who, you know, there were questions about knee soreness or things that might be more serious than that, to come in, be plus 18. And while he also had a good scoring night, a lot of it was finishing, you know, plays close to the rim. He makes so much of what they do better just because teams have to actually defend him.
Yeah, when he's aggressive. But a lot of it was just him knowing where to cut and getting dunks as the Cavaliers' defense continued to break down. But 20 points for Iguodala. He played, and he didn't just get the Mirotić. He got the, like, one of the more extreme Mirotićs you'll ever see. He played 18 straight minutes in the first half to close the half, and he played 21 straight minutes to close the second half, coming in for Pachulia every time. And on his way to that very nice 20-point night, I thought that his dunk coming down the lane in the second quarter was a pretty big play. And then the other thing too is just that in this one, despite LeBron James's heroics and his 41 points, Steph Curry and Kevin Durant outplayed James and Irving, and that was really too much for the Cavaliers to overcome.
Something else along those lines that was notable in this game was, it was another one where Stephen Curry got to the free throw line a lot. It was not his best shooting night overall. He had 20 shot attempts, 2 of 9 from 3, but he was 12 of 15 from the line, and those 3 misses were more than he usually has, but still, getting 12 free throw makes was significant for him.
Yeah, it was very interesting, the dichotomy between how he played at Oracle and how he played in Cleveland. A lot of it engendered by the way they jacked the pace up at Oracle. I mean, this has been proven empirically that they play much faster at home than they do on the road. And Curry, you mentioned 2-9 from three, but that made him 8 out of 11 on 2-point. And he really didn't take hardly any 2-pointers in Cleveland. And you mentioned, of course, the foul line as well. Had 10 assists, another 2 big offensive rebounds, and just Golden State actually out offensive rebound. I thought another big thing too, and Van Gundy was hitting this on the broadcast, I rewatched it before we started the game, or we started the podcast, was that they really made more of the hustle plays than Cleveland did. And Cleveland just wasn't quite connected enough defensively, didn't do quite enough, didn't get the effort and energy. And I think it was telling. And if you want to see what home court advantage is about, I think a lot of it, to me, this is just my subjective opinion, is those kind of effort plays, more offensive rebounding, more pressure defensively, getting the 50-50 balls. Those are the things that I think happen at home more than anything necessarily, just because the crowd is exhorting you onward.
We also saw, and we had alluded to this actually on the pregame Periscope, which feels like a lifetime ago, that the role players, you know, the idea of whether role players play better at home or on the road, the Warriors, even if we're not counting Iguodala in that way, which you can go either way with that, David West was big in this game. Patrick McCaw was a surprise. I thought he was a positive out there. Livingston, he was hit or miss, but then the Cavs backups just weren't as good in this game as they were. I mean, they were great in game four.
Yeah, they really, Jefferson, 17 minutes, only 4 points, 4 fouls, didn't have the impact on the game with some of the, I mean, he had a couple of offensive rebounds in the first half, but overall just wasn't an irritant, wasn't the type of player. He only got 1 3-point attempt off. Deron Williams had some moments defensively, but 0 of 2 on threes, including, I think, missing what in retrospect was the biggest shot of the game, a three that could have brought them within two and really maybe gotten the sphincters to tighten a little bit. That went in and out, and then on the next possession, he turned it over. Shumpert only played 4 minutes. Again, like, he was pretty key, I thought, in Cleveland, and Kyle Korver with 18 minutes. I thought it was interesting that Lou, part of the reason that they had no chance of stopping the Warriors was because Lou went probably to too much of his offensive lines, especially I felt in the fourth quarter, where he really didn't play Tristan Thompson at all very much early on. He went to Love at center, also was playing Korver at the same time. It was just very difficult to get a stop, even though, you know, we saw LeBron James late just rumbling in for a bunch of layups on Andre Iguodala. He did the same spin move in the lane 3 times in a row and just no help ever came. But that's when the Warriors were up enough that they were kind of just in no threes mode. And it was really too late for Cleveland because they just could never get any stops in the fourth quarter to start to make it interesting.
Yeah, I mean, Cleveland was scoring on most of their offensive possessions during that about 5 minute stretch late in the game, but they weren't making up much ground. And again, that was partially about why the Warriors were going for that nose threes defense, is because they knew that was the best way for Cleveland to make up the margin. And as awkward as it was to see LeBron just drive in and get basket after basket, because that's what happens when you single cover that guy, they weren't really cutting into it. And the Warriors were just kind of taking the air out of the ball in one of the strangest ways I've seen, but it worked.
Yeah, it was a big struggle for Kevin Love in this one as well. 0 for 3 on 3-pointers, all 3 of which were pretty good looks. 6 points, failed to score in the first quarter or first half, gotten 2 fouls in the first quarter. I thought actually they benefited from having him out of the game most of the time, just because that was when they were able to start thinking about defending the Warriors. And then Love even was 2 of 5 from the free throw line, did have 3 offensive boards, but, you know, just was not the same player that he was in his better performances in this series.
And he drew a couple of big fouls, but not enough to justify it in that way either.
Yeah, and he was a game worse negative 23 in this one, in a game the team lost by 9, and Tristan Thompson was only negative 7. I thought that the third quarter, though, I mean, the shot making that Cleveland had in that third quarter, I just, like, could not believe some of the shots that they made, and we'll get to it. I mean, our plan is, I think we're just going to go through the entire game here and just talk about some of our observations chronologically as we went along. But first, I would like to talk to you about Quip. Quip toothbrushes have taken electric toothbrushes and vastly improved them. First of all, they start at just $25, which is far less expensive than other electric toothbrushes. So they're named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2016. And if you just look at this thing compared to some of the competing electric toothbrushes, it's basically the size of a normal toothbrush. It doesn't have this enormous battery pack on it. In fact, it's just got one AAA battery that you replace every 3 months. And if you're on their subscription plan, they actually just send you that battery so you can just plug it right in with your new brush head. I really like it because I travel a lot. And now I actually have room for my electric toothbrush in my dop kit with Quip because it's just the size of a normal toothbrush. And for those of you who don't use electric toothbrushes at all, I really highly recommend it. I started using them, and my sister, who is rather inventive, she actually helped out with the Dunked On logo. In fact, she came up with the name sweater teeth for when you just have like plaque on your teeth and you can just feel it. And so now whenever I don't get a chance to brush with my Quip, I feel like, oh man, I've got sweater teeth again, because I actually forgot to bring it to my friend's house. I stayed over there last night and I had to use a regular toothbrush, and I was like, man, this is nowhere near as good as the Quip toothbrush is. If you're living in an urban area too, they have this wireless mirror mount. Remember, you don't have to like plug it in and charge it all the time because it's just got that AAA battery. So you can actually just put it on your mirror and then put the toothbrush in there. So I know a lot of people, if you're living in like New York or San Francisco or something, you probably might be living in like an older place that doesn't have much counter space in the bathroom. This will help you save you a bunch of space to open up one of those precious plugs for you as well. Anyway, I've gone on for quite a bit about the product, but I happen to love it. That's why getquip.com/capspace is how you get started with them. That'll give you your first refill pack free. And of course, let them know that you came from us. Getquip.com/capspace. That's a URL this time. Getquip.com/capspace. So the first quarter started. Zaza Pachulia did in fact start the game. He made it about 6 minutes. And the thing with him is it's not even sometimes just the specific stuff that he's doing. And he had a couple of nice offensive rebounds. I mean, he played about as well as he could be playing for that period. It's just the things that kind of don't happen when he's out there. Number one, he gives them somewhere to hide defensively, somewhere to help. He's just not really a threat on the roll. You can't pass it to him in certain situations. It's just everything runs much more clunkily when he's out there on offense. And then defensively, especially early on, LeBron James is able to get right to the basket, and he doesn't have the mobility, doesn't have the ability to get over and help. He actually was effective in games one and two a little bit protecting the rim, but that waned throughout the series as they realized that he just, you know, was not a threat to block a shot there. And so Steve Kerr, about 6 minutes into the game, went to Andre Iguodala, but the Cavs kept scoring. They started 6 out of 7 and got out to a pretty good lead, actually led it by 8 at one point, 41-33. And we'll get to how Golden State came back there. Love, of course, got into early foul trouble. One play was where he fouled Draymond Green in transition, where Green just pushed the ball. That was a clear foul. The other one, though, was a little controversial because he was engaged with Zaza Pachulia and was claiming that Pachulia had held his jersey. But of course, you know, he does that to everyone else. So that it was a little rich. And then he sat out the rest of the first quarter, but they actually looked pretty good without him, I thought.
They turned to Richard Jefferson. And while Jefferson wasn't really the linchpin of their offense or their defense, I thought he did a nice job. That allowed LeBron to do some things differently a little bit defensively. And yeah, I thought they looked better overall, which was surprising also because that coincided with a lot of the non-Pachulia minutes, which is when they turned to Iguodala and then later on to Sean Livingston. But again, another factor in that was then the Warriors getting in foul trouble because both Klay Thompson and Kevin Durant picked up 2 fouls and both went out earlier than they usually do.
Steph Curry actually looked really shaky early, had a lot of mishandles off the dribble. The Warriors had 6 turnovers. He had a couple of awful ones. I think he might have even had 3 in the first quarter, and Durant had 2, and the Warriors turned it over on 21% of their possessions. This game almost felt to me like it was a game 7 from the start, though, because it was just because of the history. It was like you felt like, okay, the Warriors have no cushion right now, like that even getting to a game 7 against this Cavs team would have been like a disastrous outcome. And if they lost this game, then the Cavs would have momentum. They'd be going back home and everyone would think, oh, they're automatically going to lose. And then, you know, Kerr played it that way, basically, like it was a game 7, frankly, like and with some of the lineups that he used. I mean, he played, especially because KD got into foul trouble, he played Green at center for the last 6 minutes of the first quarter, even with the Cavaliers playing with Tristan Thompson at center. Now, they didn't go with two bigs, but Kerr, when they did go with two bigs, didn't care. He just stuck with Green at center anyway. And overall, for the first quarter, I mean, Cleveland had a wonderful offensive performance, but I thought that really was more about the Warriors getting in foul trouble and screwing up and turning it over. Cleveland had 11 fast break points in the first quarter. quarter as well to the Warriors' 6, most of those coming off of turnovers. And that's why Cleveland led it 37-33 on a very fast 28 possessions after that first quarter.
And the shot that ended up giving them part of that lead, I mean, they were already going to be up one, was that crazy three by J.R. Smith, which was not his only crazy three to end a quarter.
Yeah, Kyrie Irving also in the first quarter, I think it was, had a shot where he tried to draw a foul and just jumped in and didn't get the foul call, but made the three. Maybe it was a two, but it was right on the line. We couldn't see from where we were sitting. That was really impressive. So there was a lot of great shot making. But the one thing that the Warriors did do was they took away Cleveland's three-pointers. And that, I mean, really the only lineup that they can play is Green at center to take away their threes, although they would have some success with West as well. And a couple other observations from that first quarter. There were 16 fouls in that quarter, 9 on Cleveland, 7 on Golden State. It definitely, I thought, was kind of a shaky performance from the refs early on as well. I mean, there's a pretty weak call of Shumpert on Curry, and then McCaw got called for a foul on Kyrie where he barely kind of bumped him at all. It also was looking like Cleveland was really going to hurt Golden State on the offensive glass. They had 4 offensive rebounds in that first quarter, and then another one on a loose ball foul. But it just seemed like, even with that being the case, they had to just deal with it because they just need to have a better initial shot defense playing those lines with Green at center.
Yeah, I think that's certainly a fair point. And then something I think, unless you have more on the first quarter, that I think is
there was one other thing.
Okay,
they brought in McCaw, but Ian Clark didn't play a minute in this game, and I thought that was the right move. We've been saying that McCaw should play. I thought that it was smart of Kerr to go to him, but Kyrie Irving cooked McCaw early, and McCaw did a little better in his second stint, but McCaw does like to reach in, and he was effective on Dame Lillard, for example, earlier in the playoffs and in the regular season as well. He's had played decent defense on point guards, but Kyrie got him leaning a couple of times and really beat him. And then Lou actually took Kyrie out, and it looked like Kyrie was like looking back at Lou like, hey, like I just scored like 2 buckets in a row on this guy, like don't take me out right now. But he did. He came back in while McCaw was still in there later and was matched up against him some in the second quarter as well. But that was just an interesting interplay that I noticed. I mean, I don't know if you want to disrupt what your rotation is going to be, but with Kyrie having it going, maybe it was time to give him another couple of possessions against McCaw.
Yeah, I thought, I was a little bit surprised that he pulled him at that point, just because Kyrie was rolling. And when Kyrie's rolling, I think you want to ride him, especially when, you know, he's still, it's different with him than with some other guys, because he takes tough shots sometimes when he's hot, but he also can generate such good ones because his handle is ridiculous and his shot making around the rim is just otherworldly. So I was surprised to see it a little bit, especially because you knew that there were other times you could make it work. But so where I wanted to go as we transitioned to the second quarter was, I thought one of the most significant developments that set the table for this game was Durant picking up 2 early fouls, because what that did was it forced Kerr to shift off of what has become the standard rotation. And so instead of
wonder if he would have done that anyway, because he did it in the second half, but maybe he did it because it worked in the first half.
That's my current
theory. Agree with you, like I mean, I didn't get a chance to ask him. I mean, no one asked anything about how the game went at all. That's one of the things that's kind of too bad about these championships, is it's always, oh, how does it feel, blah blah. And that's what most people are interested in. I understand that, but because nobody, I mean, maybe like the game 7 last year where it's like a really close game, close out either way, you can talk about like, all right, what, how did the actual game go? But this, for a game like this where it's like everyone's been thinking about them, is kind of viewed as fait accompli that they're going to win it, then you just get, all right, what are the emotions of this, like blah blah, which is fine. But I wish I could have talked to Kerr about what the decision making to actually go with Green at center. And I thought, actually, because, you know, we obviously like recorded part of our podcast last night and the fact that he had said he wasn't going to do this, but I had a little bit of an inkling, because you'll notice if he gets asked about something and he goes on for kind of like longer than you would expect him to, a lot of times like that means that there's some like little thing that he's trying to divert, or and you remember that they were very protective of the initial decision in game 4 of the 2015 finals to go to starting Green at center as well, on pain of death, like no one was allowed to leak it to the media. And so maybe there was a little bit of that for Kerr, or he just saw how bad it was going with Zaza and was like, all right, I gotta do this. But I think it was probably the plan all along, I would guess.
But importantly, the best lineup that the Warriors played in this entire game, in terms of plus minus and all that sort of stuff, was a lineup that had a traditional quote unquote big man, and that was with David West. David West was absolutely massive in the second quarter. He came in at the beginning and then just sat for the last 2 55, and a lot of it was, you know, he was on the floor when good things were happening, but just you could see the difference in spacing because, yeah, he can set screens and he can make good passes and he can shoot. And so he functions in a very different way than their other centers, but it's not like Pachulia was gangbusters.
He's much more mobile defensively. Yeah. He's got good hands. Like, I mean, really the only reason why, there are two reasons why you would ever play Zaza over him. I shouldn't say ever, but like why Zaza could be viewed as a better option. One is just Zaza's a better rebounder. And two, that West is like a little bit slight to guard, like true post-up centers, which the Cavs don't have any here. So West really has all the other advantages over Zaza, and he showed why in that second quarter tonight.
Right, yeah, and so he was plus 17 just in that quarter, partially because of that, what was in many ways the key run of the game, which was the Warriors' 22-2 run, basically as soon as Steph Curry came back in the floor. And the Warriors scored on 13 consecutive trips down the floor. It wasn't necessarily that they didn't miss any shots. There were a few times where they got offensive rebounds, and there was one weird possession where their score was on a 3-second violation, and so they got the technical free throw, and then West turned it over. But scoring on 13 consecutive possessions is really, really hard to overcome, and they were getting a lot of stops, of course, because the two part of that 22-2 is important as well.
Yeah, and that's actually, it was 41-33, and at that point, I mean, there definitely was some worry going through the building, like Game 7 style, that like, I can't believe this is going on. Like, they looked really ugly offensively to start the second quarter, where they didn't really have much of a plan when KD was getting trapped on screen rolls. There wasn't really an outlet for him. Kyle Korver was actually playing some nice denial defense on Klay Thompson when they tried to get him the ball as an outlet. West wasn't making himself available when they would trap. And it was looking pretty ugly there. And then they started to get it going with Iguodala. And Cleveland's inability to score during that period, I thought, was even more their downfall than the offense, although Golden State did make 11 of 12 shots. In the midst of that 22-2 run, they took it from 41-33 to 61-45. So that was actually a 28-4 run, really, would probably be the better descriptor there. I'll give you some stats from that. Cleveland shot 2 for 11, 0 of 3 on three-pointers. Love, Jefferson, and Shumpert missing them. LeBron only took one field goal attempt during that 7 minutes, and Irving was 0 for 3. Meanwhile, Tristan Thompson had a couple of turnovers as well. And I thought the Cavs actually looked a little bit shook during that. Like, Love would have had an open three bobbled a pass in the quarter. Thompson lost a pass on the baseline that could have been a dunk out of bounds. And Golden State during that period shot 10 out of 15, but 5 out of 8 on three-pointers. KD, 3 of 4. He scored 11 points during that run. And I thought, like, one of the huge shots was late clock. Everything was covered up. He hadn't dribbled yet, but there was, like, 5 seconds on the clock. He'd been holding the ball for, like, 10 seconds, and then he just rose up for a 28-footer over LeBron, and LeBron could have done a better job getting out of it. And I thought actually that just in general was one of my big takeaways, is that LeBron was not able to bring enough defensive energy in this game to really carry his team forward. Help defense, rebounding, on-ball defense wasn't quite as good as it could have been. And I think it really, you know, when KD was going like this, it definitely tired him out. And I think also, like, we have to recognize, when are we ever going to see, you know, probably... And we can take stock of it, but certainly two top five players in the league guarding each other like this, and guarding each other even like without screens a lot of times too, just like in ISOs one-on-one much of the game. I know Andre guarded and Richard Jefferson were involved guarding each other guy, but you know, for half the game these guys were guarding each other, and that was just an incredible part of what the show of this finals was all about.
And that really ties in with the whole kind of the idea, not that it was a bold take, but to get Kevin Durant in the first place, is that he made LeBron James specifically made his life so much harder, because it took away so many other things for Cleveland, and Cleveland didn't really have many other options. Jefferson had him, as you said, Jefferson guarded Durant a little bit, but not that much. And so LeBron had this really tough role where he's guarding one of the best offensive players in the league, the best offensive players of the last 10, 20 years. And then that limited his ability to be much of a help defender, when at the same time, Ty Lue was going away from Tristan Thompson, who was another one of their better help defenders.
Yeah, that was a problem. I mean, I thought Thompson played more, but you can point to Thompson being out there is maybe why they struggled to score a little bit, but they didn't struggle to score with him out there in the third. Again, the thing that was so big as Golden State was able to get out to leading it 69-52 at one point was that Cleveland basically had five attempts from three through like the first probably 20 minutes of this game. I remember they were 23 out of 45 on threes last game, and they shot 44 the game before that. So just limiting those attempts, I mean, even though Cleveland shot a great percentage, again, 11 out of 24, that 24 attempts was huge for Golden State to hold them down that much, even if they were giving up a lot in the paint ultimately. And also, it should be noted too, during that run, at one point the Warriors scored on nine straight possessions and they had 24 points, including the technical fouls, which we'll have to get to at some point.
We will have to get to that at some point. But before that, I want to talk about what happened right after that run, because I thought that was kind of what set the table for what came later, which was this. So Kerr saw Durant was in, you know, was in foul trouble and everything else like that. So he pulled him with 1:10 left.
Yeah. And he had two fouls.
Yeah, he had two. Yeah. So I guess foul trouble might be putting it a little strongly. So Curry makes the free throw as he's taken out. So the Warriors are up 69-52, 17 point lead. Then off a Kyrie offensive rebound, he had a couple big ones in this series, including one in game three, which ended up not swinging the outcome. Gets the ball to JR. JR hits a huge three. Curry misses. LeBron gets a layup, passed by Darren. Then Iguodala has a dunk, which is too early. It's with 6 seconds left with the shot clock off, or functionally off.
Well, I don't know about that. Actually, it's funny. I was watching it with my girlfriend because she didn't have a chance to watch the game. And so she was like, was that too early? Like, should they take the 2-for-1 at that point? I'm like, if you have a straight up dunk or a wide open layup, like, yeah, I think you probably should take, especially when it's under 10 seconds and you're going to put time pressure.
It was at 6-3. I think that's the part of it. But it was just, in my brain, I was going, they're going to give up something here.
And because any team bringing it full court against the Warriors at the end of a quarter like turns into the Monstars, like as J.R. Smith proved with that great shot.
Yeah, and then J.R. hits, I mean, I thought it was a really tough shot, 27 footers the way it's listed, makes that. So then the lead in that minute 10 went from 17 to 11.
About that whole technical altercation, I never really got a good angle on it if like Wes really threw an inappropriate elbow when he was engaged with Kyrie, but he does have a history of when he gets in those tie-up situations like throwing some bows, and so I think Dan Crawford knowing that was very quick with the whistle. But if you're going to make that call as a technical, you have to call the held ball earlier, right? Because it, like basically as the held ball was being called, he's also calling him for the technical, which is like you have to let him know that like play has been stopped or he's going to just keep trying to like rip the ball away, you know. And then Smith really just like got a running start, ran in and gave West a shove, and then, you know, Thompson, I presume, said something untoward to get his technical. But that was my only comment on that. I mean, I thought JR and certainly deserved it. Tristan probably did. I didn't hear what he said, but and maybe West had something to say to Irving that was inappropriate. West will certainly do that from time to time when he's involved in physical situations. But that was my only comment on that. I thought it was, other than that, it was officiated just fine.
And it made some sense to me that you sometimes you punish the people who get into the spat after the fact. And I think that's kind of what they were getting at with the Tristan part and the JR thing, is that those guys were not involved in the original altercation. They came over and inserted themselves in the situation. It's hard to know, obviously, the full stuff without the context, but I know the league wants to kind of crack down on that sort of behavior, just because if you can remove that incentive, then it can reduce the risk of these things spiraling, which is always a concern. Given back to even like long ago histories, that those, sometimes it's those players not involved in the original altercation that make the thing much worse.
Yeah, so we talked about the Golden State's defense being better, and Cleveland did get 33 shots to the rim, high paced game, but that's still a lot of shots. They shot 70% on those, including some absolutely spectacular finishes, and they shot well on threes as well, but not a ton of attempts, 24 for this Cleveland team. And they still overall for the game managed a 122 offensive rating, 120 points points on 98 possessions. But Golden State had 129 on 98, so they finished with 132 offensive rating. But what they didn't do at all in those two games in Cleveland, they managed, the Warriors did in this game, to force Cleveland into taking 31 long twos, or not long twos, but twos outside the restricted area. And Cleveland, again, shot pretty well on those, but at least on shots in the lane. But overall on those, they were 13 out of 31. And also those shots don't lead to free throws nearly as often as well. So it was, and Golden State actually got more free throw attempts, held Cleveland to only 23, and then Cleveland didn't shoot that one, only 15 out of 23. So that was really the math of getting just enough defense, even though really Cleveland shot making in this game was pretty spectacular. I mean, so many of these shots were contested.
And Cleveland has special scorers in that sort of a capacity. It's part of the, I gained appreciation. I tweeted this during the game. It's just watching Kyrie, I'm sure it works on television. I mean, I saw it with games 3 and 4 when we did the Twitter NBA show, but watching, especially it was in that second quarter when they were coming towards us, the shot making that he had, or no, that was in the third quarter. The shot making was absolutely incredible. And like, you're watching him, and you know, we've watched a lot of basketball. We've watched a lot, fortunate enough to watch a lot in person, and you're seeing him do things and you just go, how is that possible? And that's what makes Kyrie special, is that he can pull that out. Now LeBron does it in a different type of way. He can create space and everything like that. But to watch those guys do it and then to have JR on top of it when he was on was amazing.
Yeah, I mean, Smith was the guy I actually was probably the most amazed by. But Irving did cool off towards the end, took some very difficult attempts, and he wasn't able to get to the rim off the dribble as much. They had more help. They at least were cutting him off and forcing him to take long twos, which he was able to make, but he wasn't able to like get to the rim and do those finishes. Their help at the rim was much better, again, in large part, I think, because of the quickness that they have to get over there and help. I mean, it's really, sometimes it's more about that than even being big and tall at the rim, especially against someone like Kyrie, to just get your body in front of him or make him see bodies and pull up for a tough mid-ranger. And Irving actually finally finished with 26 points on 25 shooting possessions, which is not, for considering the overall level of efficiency of both of these teams and the amount of shooting that they have around them, that actually doesn't really qualify as a great game. Also had 4 turnovers. And LeBron's line, of course, we have to say, to 41 points, 19 out of 30 from the field, 2 of 5 on threes, and 8 assists, 13 rebounds. Another incredible offensive game from him, although they were kind of letting him get a little bit of what he wanted late just to take away the threes intentionally. But yeah, I mean, both of those guys couldn't match still the efficiency that KD had with 39 points on only 23 shooting possessions for him, and then Curry, 34 points on 28 shooting possessions. So he was closer to kind of where LeBron was. And it became just a little bit too much to just make contested shot after contested shot when the Warriors were just getting open threes and dunks every possession.
Do you have anything else on the second, or are you ready to move on to the
third? No. Well, just in general, we talked about Kerr. Not only did we see a ton of green at center, but it was basically just run whatever you want, pick and rolls just about every single time. You know, it wasn't the off ball stuff. They're getting held like crazy. They're like, all right, we're not going to do that anymore. And we finally saw the Steph KD pick and roll just become completely unguardable in this one, in the third quarter especially. We saw it in the second, and then in the third it really kept the Warriors afloat for a while as Cleveland was scoring incredibly well themselves. And Cleveland does not want to switch that, because that would have left Kyrie Irving on Kevin Durant, and that just let KD get out open on the wing in space, as they would just run basically a side pick and roll, lob it up to KD. Then Lou adjusted and went with J.R. Smith on Curry so that they could switch that, but Smith couldn't really guard Durant either. And then, you know, they started finding guys like Iguodala for dunks coming down the lane. And your other problem there when they run that play is Klay Thompson's in the opposite corner. I mean, I tweeted out a screenshot of this. I mean, there's a play where KD is going in for a layup, and on the opposite side, 3-point line, J.R. Smith is not even looking at the ball, and he's basically just like holding Klay Thompson, just like by himself, basically. And they can also hold the weak side help there, because they would have the other two guys, while Steph and Klay ran that pick and roll, get ready to set a double screen wide pin down for Klay Thompson to come to the top. So that would engage everyone else, prevent the help from coming over. And it was completely unstoppable as a play, even though Cleveland continued their incredible shot making in that quarter to the tune of 33 points on only 22 possessions, 150 offensive rating in that quarter. The best any team had in any quarter in terms of offensive rating in this game.
It was Celtics versus Wizards-esque, because I think that was in the early games of those series, someone had a 150 rating in like every single quarter. But I thought the third was fascinating for a couple different reasons, and one of them was the dynamics that were in place in terms of Kerr and then in terms of Lou with the rotations, because Kyrie again came out when, you know, he had his moments both directions in that, but Zaza Pachulia, Kerr gave him about as much rope as he could feasibly do. He committed 3 fouls in 4 minutes and 7 seconds. I think at least 2 of them were offensive.
Three of them, he committed 3 fouls in like 30 seconds and then got taken out.
That's true, yeah, because the first couple minutes he was clean. But I was just saying, in his overall stint, you're right, though, it wasn't a shorter time period. I'm going to look it up.
I just rewatched it. It's definitely like 30 seconds or less. He committed 2 fouls out on the floor defensively on the same possession, I think. And then he held Kevin Love, committing his second foul of the series on that play, where he just held Kevin Love, preventing him from coming over to help out on a layup.
I just went through it. 3 fouls in 38 seconds.
Really was hoping it could be a half a minute less. And again, Kerr was just like, I'm going to Andre Iguodala right away, and actually played the whole death lineup for like 6 minutes. And Cleveland was still coming back. I mean, some of these shots that they hit, right? There was JR hitting a fadeaway bailout 3 from the left corner with the shot clock expiring. Irving got a cut and just went right into the chest of Draymond Green and shot a layup. He hit a fadeaway over Kevin Durant in semi-transition. Tristan Thompson got into the act with like a ridiculous layup over Green. LeBron had that and one where he came across the lane and basically just like ran into Curry and threw it up over his shoulder and rimmed it in. It was really, and then the one really like wide open play that they got in that quarter, I mean, because that was what was so incredible about it, right? Was, I mean, they scored 32 points on 22 possessions and they got maybe like 2 what you would say like really good shots the whole quarter. And the one of those was LeBron coming down the lane and then throwing the one-handed off the dribble lefty oop to Tristan Thompson, who skied on that play. That was incredible. And it really just was one of the more remarkable offensive quarters that I've ever seen a team have. To just the fight that they showed offensively in that quarter is incredible. They probably didn't quite have enough fight on the other end to really make just quite enough of a push to really make Golden State sweat.
The Thompson shot was also big because it took some of the air out of the arena. That was the shot that cut the lead all the way down to 4. It was 90-86, and then Durant came right back down, hit a big 3, and
that
pushed it back up to 7.
Huge.
Yeah, I thought that was one of the biggest shots of the entire game. And the Deron Williams one that missed were two of the biggest ones for me. And then that also
that was the one where Durant just caught it at the top of the key. RJ just kind of like swiped at it, but it was still an awful shot from Durant early in the clock, and he just, you know, but he's Kevin Durant and he made it. Like, it's just, he's like, I'm gonna just personally hero ball stem the tide, and he did it.
And immediately after that, with the timeout, Steve Kerr went to another adjustment, which was he went against the grain and actually used David West in the third quarter. And I thought West was fine during that stretch. They did end up technically getting outscored, but that wasn't really his fault. And, you know, that ended up being the final minutes that the Warriors played this entire season with a center on the floor.
Yeah, that's right. They went to Green at center for the entire fourth quarter. And I mean, it was funny when I asked Kerr about it, and he had that answer for me on Sunday. He basically said, I haven't played that lineup more than like 16 or 18 minutes a game. And in this one, that lineup played 27 minutes. Pachulia played 10 and West played 11. And the rest of the time it was Green at center, and Green played 44 minutes in this game. Kerr, that was another one where he just brought Green right back in after like a minute and a half rest in the third, brought Durant back in to start the fourth quarter after like a minute and a half rest. He played 40 minutes, but a lot of that was just due to the foul trouble. He would have played more. Really just a pretty aggressive performance. I mean, I wish I could have asked him, but it seemed like he was really just treating this like it was a game seven and just, we are not going back to Cleveland. And that was, I thought that in this one, actually, I think we're saying that maybe Lou had the coaching advantage through the first four games. I thought Kerr actually did better with his rotations in this one.
Yeah, I would certainly say so. And he went to his best players and some of those lineups that were more viable. And he was willing to move off of things that didn't work more quickly, which is something we both have praised Lou for at other points in this series. And I thought that Kerr did a nice job of that in this one. And then that led into, not saying we have to talk about the fourth quarter now, but one of the more ridiculous things to me about this game was it was, you know, ended up being a clinch game in the NBA Finals. Only six players for Golden State played in the fourth quarter. The Hamptons five, so Curry, Klay Thompson, Iguodala, Durant, and Green, and Patrick McCaw.
I was surprised he went back to McCaw, because McCaw had a pretty ugly stint in the first half where he really badly missed two open corner threes. But he was big down the end of the third quarter at working as a screener in pick and roll. And I just, like, his composure just impresses me so much. I mean, he's calm. He makes the right play. I mean, he challenged LeBron and scored on a layup. He missed one, but got his own rebound and laid it in. And then he had another play where Clay, although he missed the three, he got the ball for an open corner three, and then he passed that up to get it to Clay immediately. I mean, I think his ability to drive and just he's very efficient. He's almost like an analytics guy's dream, where he's like, all right, I know I have the shot here, but I'm just gonna try and get Klay Thompson or Steph Curry a wide open three just by driving under control, drawing help, and he's driving to pass in a composed way that not a lot of rookies have. So he was good. I think he's gonna play more of a role, even if he did have his struggles at times.
Well, and he also had a big play in the third quarter on a putback. It was this strange play
I mentioned that one. Yeah.
Yeah. Where he biffed the layup the first time, from what I recall. And yeah, it's fascinating to see how a guy like him can kind of get into different spots, because if you remember, he burst into a larger role when Durant had to go out again in the Portland series. He stepped up and did a nice job in that one. And so just the way that his role has shifted over the course of the season, as you said, it's hard to pinpoint exactly what it's going to be next year, but it certainly looks like he'll be a part of the rotation, especially considering how highly guys like Iguodala talk of him and his work ethic.
I will talk about the fourth quarter and Cleveland's attempts to come back there. But first, this from SeatGeek. You know all about them by now. They're the inaugural sponsor of the Dunked On podcast. They've supported us quite well, and you guys have supported them in turn, because they're still here almost 2 years later now, exactly from when they first reached out to me. A guy named Will Flaherty reached out to me there back in the old days of the terrible audio quality. And despite that, they were still willing to give us a shot and say, hey, you know, a lot of people in our office listen to your show. We like it. We'd like to come on your show. I think that we were one of the first podcasts that they ever did. Now they're a little more ubiquitous, but they're ubiquitous because their advertising works. People actually really like their service. The reason why is they aggregate ticket selling together. So now you don't have to go to a bunch of different sites and worry that you're missing out on a deal. And then they also rank every ticket based on value. So their algorithms are excellent. I know Danny has been impressed by them, despite the fact that he has personal expertise, worked in the ticket business. So he would know. And so now you can just go into the SeatGeek app, look generally in the section you want to sit, whether it's a concert, sporting event, really anything that has tickets, check out SeatGeek for it. Pick the best ranked ticket, and now you're done in a minute and a half, instead of like what used to be a 20-minute process where you're still worried that you didn't get the best deal. SeatGeek gives you that peace of mind that you did get the best deal. When you get started with them, download the SeatGeek app, go into the settings tab, click add a promo code, and enter that familiar promo code CAPSPACE. All one word, easy to remember. We talk about it all the time on the program. And SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your first purchase. That's SeatGeek, promo code CAPSPACE. By the way, Dang, speaking of promo code CAPSPACE, I tweeted this out today. Soon will be available a limited number of Dunked On t-shirts, coffee mugs, and I think we might do hats too. There's only going to be 100 t-shirts though as a test run. I will be letting you guys know how you can get your hands on those, but the t-shirts are pretty cool. It's got the Dunked On logo, the new one on the front, that's got the guy actually dunking. And then the back, people actually thought this was pretty funny, has just like a little, like very small lettering on like the top of the back, that just says CAPSPACE, which is... I just couldn't resist putting that on there. I thought that would, I wish what we talked about during the game was, and someone tweeted this out, so I think it'd be pretty funny, but I don't think there's really a way to do this. If like every t-shirt could just have like some point that we were making, Danny, like someone suggested, like Solomon Hill, Pacers not picking up his fourth year rookie option, like that would just be on the back of the t-shirt. Like every t-shirt would have like a different one like that. That would be pretty funny.
We definitely need to make one for Feldman that says Bucks here.
I mean, it doesn't even have to say Dunked On. It could just say Bucks here. Bucks here.
You can make an alternate Dunked On logo that just says Bucks here. That's getting a little too far afield.
Yeah. But other than the fact that, you know, the Milwaukee Bucks is like an actual like trademarked entity, so we probably can't
use. Yeah, and considering I went on a little bit of a tirade during the last Twitter NBA show about how we weren't going to violate copyrights, I feel like I shouldn't do that in this case. But
I don't even. Anyway, we're getting far afield here. I thought that Lou, and this was the case as well in, I think, both the first two games in Oakland, when Thompson, granted, was not playing well, Tristan Thompson, but we were critical of him, and I think rightly so, because whenever he gets down, he always goes for all offense. And again, it was Love and Korver together, and anytime they went at Love in a pick and roll, they either had to trap immediately, or, you know, it was Love on a switch against Curry and Durant, and that was an immediate disaster as well, especially with the amount of spacing that they had around those two guys. So it was, and Korver, he tries, but just not that good of a help defender, like can't get stuck on Curry on a switch either. And they didn't have any answers. And I thought, obviously there are a ton of bad options, but I think just generally you have to just switch against Golden State. And if Kevin Durant's going to score over you in ISO, or Steph Curry is going to hit a step back in an ISO or something, I mean, okay, but that's better than giving up a dunk, which is kind of like what they were doing throughout most of this game. But I mean, honestly, it probably wouldn't have made much of a difference either. It was very interesting, though, because when did he take Love out in the third quarter? It was like 4 minutes in or something. It was pretty early on. And then he sat, I think, the entire rest of the third quarter. And then he brought him back at center to start the fourth.
Yeah, I think he played about six in the third. But what I thought was wild was that Tristan Thompson played 10 minutes and 12 seconds in the third quarter. I thought he was looking pretty solid out there. I mean, not perfect, but solid. They were plus five during his minutes. And then, as you said, he played three and a half minutes in the fourth quarter. So just sitting there going like, what is the rationale for that? And it was surprising to me, as you said, the idea that when things start to get troublesome, do that. But the reason Cleveland was in that game was because they were playing better defense and hitting some ridiculous shots too.
Yeah, their D was a little bit better in the third quarter. At least they're forcing some difficult shots. LeBron actually brought them within three with the first bucket of the third or fourth quarter. And then it was KD again, another just like tough 17-footer, and Kyrie missed a tough three. Andre Iguodala hit a huge three after that, and they never really got any closer than five after that Kevin Love crazy and one on Klay Thompson, where Klay was claiming that Love grabbed his arm, but he also reached in. And that was followed by a crazy KD three-pointer off a McCaw assist. Again, another like nice, composed drive by McCaw, and that put the Warriors up eight, and that Cleveland really never threatened again. They got within six after a Kyle Korver three, but then again, that, you know, it was a KD dunk. Andre got a dunk right after that, put the Warriors up 10, and it never got closer than eight the rest of the way.
Something I didn't notice that when we were at the game, I mean, anecdotally, you noticed each one. Every single quarter, the last made shot was a three-pointer by J.R. Smith.
Oh, even in the fourth quarter?
He hit that shot with 18 seconds to go.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that.
That's incredible. And it was also a callback to game six of the 2015 finals, where he went crazy at the end when it looked like the Warriors were already going to win and change the margin.
The 2015 finals, yeah.
Yeah, 50. Something we haven't talked about, mostly because we focus on the game and all that, but I thought, by and large, I thought the Oracle crowd was better for this game than I expected. They were tense at moments, just because you had the ghosts of Game 7 there, but they were strong for the most part, and then you could tell their confidence level in that fourth quarter was kind of waxing and waning, and then once they felt like, okay, this is over, then they really let loose.
Yeah, it was definitely, I mean, I mentioned it kind of felt like a Game 7 in there with the like how tense it was and just what happened last year. But it's so funny the way you can be in a series and then when it's over, it seems like it was inevitable. You know, it was, I think though really Cleveland lost this series really in game one. I thought they played better in game two, but game one was kind of an embarrassing effort, and they should have lost game one by like 35 points. Like to give up 34 shots in the restricted area in the first half to Golden State. I mean, I know they're supposed to be like, they're so hard to play. There's an adjustment period. We were just playing the Celtics without Isaiah Thomas, but they did the same thing last year, right? Like they should have been able to find a way to be a little more competitive considering how well they played later in the series, just to not quite be ready to where they needed to be on either end in that first game, I think is what they'll look back on. And obviously game three as well. But I mean, game three could have turned on just, you know, a few shots here or there, whereas game one was just overall a very poor effort from them and disappointing just because we saw that they were capable of so much more later in the series.
Yeah, I mean, they were competitive in 3, 4, and 5, and they played, I mean, they didn't play better in game five than game four, but I would say by and large, they were improving over the course of the series and they got some really strong performances in game five as well. And I like that the series, even if it ended at 4-1, I don't think people walk away from this thinking less of the Cavs, and they certainly should not, because they, other than game one, they fought gamely, they were close, they were in it for a lot of it, and they were getting these performances. And so you're sitting there I wasn't sitting there saying, oh well, this team has like no chance if they face each other next year at full strength. I mean, it's still gonna take a lot, you know, if that's what we get next year. Hopefully whoever makes the finals, it's full strength versus full strength. But I was really impressed with Cleveland overall.
Yeah, I was too, but they got to get a little bit more connected. I mean, they had some pretty bad errors in this game. When you compare if Cleveland with their switching versus like Golden State's communication defensively, now they don't have the talent defensively that Golden State does. I get that. But, and maybe players like Irving and Smith, usually the miscommunication would involve those two guys, just can't do it. For example, the Warriors, whenever they wanted to get a screen of like Kyle Korver involved in a screen or Kevin Love involved in a screen, they just had their guy kind of trot up there and they did it. Whereas when Cleveland would try that, the Warriors would pre-switch it. They would push under the right area of the floor. You know, it just made everything so much more difficult. And I thought two things that stuck out to me about the series. Steph Curry, other than just a couple of ugly stretches, he held up defensively. And I thought it was interesting, like Kevin Durant's comments saying like Steph Curry is a big dog. You know, he got to the foul line for double digit attempts in the three games in Oakland. And, you know, they tried to go at him and they really had to abandon that and go after Golden State centers. And then they took that away by not playing said centers. McGee also didn't play it at all in this game. But I mean, when they, especially in this game, when they tried, and I thought their execution was bad on those plays too, like they weren't getting the pop for Kyrie or for J.R. Smith, who was usually setting the screen as normal, like they're trying to like roll to the basket and stuff. It just didn't really work out as well. They weren't Darren Williams when he was trying to set the screen to get McCaw onto LeBron, just like wasn't making contact on the screen at all. He was just slipping it and then, you know, nothing would happen as a result. But yeah, I think just Cleveland, their connectedness and their communication can be better. And LeBron did make the point that J.R. Smith missed most of the year. You know, Kevin Love came back very late in the season after knee surgery and looked to be experiencing some discomfort at times as well. Iman Shumpert, I think, missed a bunch of time, as I recall, too. So it was really, I mean, remember in that Christmas Day game, DeAndre Liggins started that game and he didn't even finish the season on the team. Maybe that really hurt their attempts to establish some defensive continuity. Last thing, because I know you got to record with Adam briefly here. And are you ready to think about where this team is among the greats? I mean, I think clearly to me, there's no argument whatsoever that this season's Warriors team is a top five team ever. I think that like there's really no argument against that to me. It's just how high do they go? And maybe we'll talk about that more at some point. And Kevin Pelton said by his statistical method, based in large part on what they did in the playoffs, and they had a great regular season record and point differential as well. I mean, this was probably the, if you were going going to combine regular season and postseason record, probably the best, I guess you could say the least bad that any team has ever been when you combine both of those two, because they're outstanding in both. This is really the first team, maybe you could say the 92 Bulls, but they did lose those three games, two after maybe the series was already decided, to Seattle, losing games 4 and 5. But in the 96 Bulls would really probably be their only competition in that regard, I would say, historically.
You are a student of the league's history more than I am, so I am only going to speak to my own experience. But the way that I have thought about this team over the last week is not so much in terms of the best team, but I think they're the best collection of talent that I've ever seen. And I want to draw that distinction just because they didn't always reach their defensive ceiling. They didn't, you know, it took, there was that adjustment period, which is very different than the 96 Bulls to me, where the 96 Bulls,
remember when they couldn't stop anybody for like the first five games of the year? That,
yeah,
like,
and exactly.
I think it was almost exclusively, I think, just because they're having their centers lay back in the pick and roll, and
yeah, the Pachulia being unplayable on defense.
Yeah, right. I mean, those guys just couldn't execute that coverage.
And then their crunch time offense started, was a big story in late December and early January.
That's
and
right,
so,
yeah.
So that's why I focus more on the collection of talent. Like, and I feel comfortable talking about that at this point. And then the team part of it, it gets a little bit more complicated. I think you're talking ceiling and floor and everything like that, but they're special. And it was amazing to see what this team could do differently from last year. Or last year, it was, you know, that they grinded out every single game. They went 73-9, but they weren't nearly as good as they were this year, just overall in terms of everything. And that, it all ties back with the finals MVP. Kevin Durant scored 30 or more points in all five finals games. I think I heard that it was only the sixth time ever that that's happened, or maybe it's in like certain modern era or some sort of catch-all that I didn't hear. But he was incredible in this series and provided the Warriors a backstop in numerous moments. And I thought that was really present in this game five.
Do you think LeBron James, as of this moment, is still the best player in the world?
Yes.
I mean, this series, he had a better series, I think, this year, although we didn't see it as much defensively, but this was obviously a much harder team to defend than last year's relatively crippled version. And again, by the way, like, when I'm saying that this is really like some of the best collections of talent that we've ever seen on one floor, I mean, there weren't really any major injuries right now. Everyone was pretty much healthy. Everyone was playing really well. I mean, like, so many, all of these guys had like some really good games in this series. And just the fact that, and look no further than the fact that LeBron James had an incredibly efficient 41 point night tonight, and the end of the game wasn't even close. I mean, like, what other team could just withstand that? I mean, these teams are just putting up like $115, $120 on each other. Like, it's nothing. It's really just incredible, incredible offensive stuff. I mean, and like, even like for the Warriors, like Thompson and Green combined to go 7 out of 23 in this game. And they still scored incredibly well themselves. Some of the offensive ratings in this series, and just the amount of talent, I don't know when we're ever going to see that again. I mean, even if it is these two teams again next year, I mean, basically all of the relevant players, except for maybe Klay Thompson and Kyrie Irving, are probably going to not be quite as good this year as they were last year, or I'm sorry, next year as they were this year.
Yeah, we should definitely appreciate this series for what it was, and thankfully we got through it unmarred. I even think back to when we worried about LeBron getting a concussion in game 3, you know, that those sorts of things didn't affect this series, and it was a lot of fun. And even though it only lasted 5 games, I was blown away more times in this series than I can remember. And it was from a lot of individual players, some great team play, adjustments, and yeah, I mean, it was a blast. It was an absolute blast.
I'm unlike a lot of people, I think, in that I just like what is going on the floor and the players who are playing. I think I can derive more enjoyment out of that sometimes than just the drama of, oh my God, who's going to win. You know, I just like the aesthetics of seeing like great basketball played in front of me. And again, we may never see quite this way. I mean, even if these two teams match up next year, maybe not everyone is healthy. You know, like that could be an issue, or, you know, players will leave, or it will just be old. Like Andre Iguodala, can he do this at 34? The way he did it at 33 to get like, what, you know, 6 dunks or whatever it was today, like, maybe not. So appreciate this, and I wish we would have had more games of it. But do you think that Cleveland wins the series if the Warriors bring back a similar team from last year?
Oh, you mean like if they re-sign Harrison Barnes?
Yeah. And Barnes presumably would have shown some modicum of growth as he did in Dallas, probably not quite to that level.
I think the Warriors would have been favorites, but it would have been like maybe like 55-45 for me, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, to see how well Cleveland played at times, it would have been a very close series. And so that was probably the one downside of Kevin Durant signing in Golden State. I would have liked to have had the narrative of it, really, because this whole, oh, it's redemption for Golden State. It's not like quite redemption. Like, you got like another top five player in the league. Like, it's not really, you know, for Joe Lacob being like, we thought we were the better team last year. Like, this doesn't prove that they were the better team last year. You know, like, this is, you got Kevin Durant and you won the series pretty easily, but it was one of the harder fought seven or five game series that you'll see, I guess. All right, any closing thoughts before we go? I know you got to get on to talk with Adam.
Well, I want to thank everybody. I mean, what's fun and why part of the reason I love doing this so much with you is that this is, for many people, this is the end of their season or the end of their basketball. This is absolutely not the end for us. We're just getting started, but it is a transition. And so I feel like at every transition, I want to take a second to just appreciate everyone who helps make this possible. And that is, you know, it's everybody for listening, it's our sponsors for sponsoring, and everybody for spreading the word, because this is a life that I genuinely never saw coming, and it has been so much fun.
I got no time to appreciate anything. I gotta go watch some Frank Tilakina film as soon as we're done recording here. No, seriously, thanks everyone for listening. Also want to give a shout out to my buddy Zach at UCSF, who played basketball against him today. Dunked on listener joined our media game. That was fun. I told him I'd give him a shout out on the pod. He actually, we played a game of 21 at the end with me, Bontemps, and him, and he didn't score for like, it was like 12-12-0 at one point. So I told him I was gonna shout him out for scoring 0 points, and then he like went on a run and played well. But thanks for listening, Zach. Enjoyed meeting you today. And that'll do it for today's program. We'll be back tomorrow. We got all sorts of off-season preview stuff still to do. We got the mock off season coming up. The NBA draft is a mere 10 days away now, so we can't wait to spend all that time with you going into free agency. Talk to you all soon.